I'm Arun Vanagopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 27th, we'll be wrapping up our guns and domestic violence series by talking solutions.
A domestic violence investigator. He is looking for people who have been charged with domestic violence-related offenses and who have a restraining order against them and who could possess firearms.
Also on the show, we speak to Laura Nyreiter, an attorney who's exposing the U.S. criminal justice system on wrongful convictions.
You got to look at it with objective eyes, and you've got to have a legal framework in place that recognizes what every layperson sees when you hear these stories, which is, this is wrong. It shouldn't happen this way.
But first, we take a look at authoritarianism around the world and here in the U.S. Is it the right term to describe what we're seeing here at home? Let's talk about it. For years now, many politicians, political analysts, and everyday voters have been shocked by the rhetoric and the actions of President Trump, calling them extreme, unprecedented, and even authoritarian.
We also saw the president this week demonstrate once again that he has no respect for the rule of law.
I worry very much when we have a president who I fear very much is moving us in a very authoritarian direction.
Right in front of our eyes, we are watching a descent into authoritarianism.
And since the president has been acquitted in his impeachment trial, he's moved even faster to consolidate power and oust people who he considers insufficiently loyal to him. But as we in the U.S. look at history to try and understand and contextualize Trump's actions, around the world we're seeing a rise in leaders who are also changing the norms and institutions of their countries, places where the threat of authoritarianism is very real. So we decided to talk to three people who have expertise in different parts of the world, in Europe, Asia, and Latin America, to see what lessons other countries have for what we're seeing in the U.S. right now.
My name is Joshua Kurlansik, and I'm Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations.
My name is Yasha Monk. I'm an Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins University, and we author of The People versus Democracy.
My name is Alejandro Velasco. I'm an Associate Professor of Latin American History at New York University.
And as you'll hear, they don't always agree about whether or not President Trump's actions compared to authoritarian leaders around the world.
I do think it's accurate to talk about Donald Trump as an aspiring authoritarian.
Comparing Donald Trump to someone like Duterte or even Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's another prominent illiberal populist, I think it's a pretty significant stretch.
I don't actually think that Donald Trump is undermining U.S. institutions. He understands keenly how institutions and the institutional design of the United States can be actually deployed to satisfy authoritarian goals.
A lot to unpack here. We started the conversation with Yasha explaining the link between authoritarianism and populism, and talking about how populist leaders can exhibit authoritarian tendencies.
Now, what populists have in common is not an ideological hue, a set of economic policies they agree on, but they basically all say, I and I alone truly speak for the people. I'm the only legitimate expression of the people's will, and so if anybody disagrees with me, that's illegitimate. That has happened again and again in the history of democracy, and it has happened in many countries over the last 10 or 20 years. It was true of somebody like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. It was also true of more right-wing populist leaders like Recep Erdogan in Turkey or Viktor Orban in Hungary. And I think the way to understand that is through this concept of populism. And what we've seen in the last years, and especially, may I say, in the last weeks and the last months, is Donald Trump trying to politicize the Department of Justice, to purge, as we have just learned, members of the executive with whom he disagrees. And that's a way, I think, of saying all of the power should stem from him. We should concentrate more power in his own hands. And all of the kind of separation of power and the rule of law, which we need in order to sustain our individual liberties, which we need in order to sustain our ability to throw an elected leader out of office if we don't like him anymore, are things which he is quite hostile to.
Joshua, I'm curious. We hear this comparison between Donald Trump here in the U.S. and other leaders such as Erdogan. How do you see this comparison?
I mean, I think Trump is more classified perhaps with someone like Silvio Berlusconi, who was sort of an antecedent to some of these actors in Italy. Berlusconi then gave way to sort of, he corroded the discourse in Italy and led to other future populists, somewhat liberal populists, But I think comparing Donald Trump to someone like Duterte or even Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's another prominent illiberal populist, I think it's a pretty significant stretch.
Look, I think it's important to be careful. And I certainly don't believe that Donald Trump at this point has undermined American democracy to any comparable extent as Recep Erdogan has done in Turkey. And it's very important to be explicit about that. Nevertheless, I fear it's possible to fall into a kind of false complacency. Autocrats have very often been elected when they first got into power. The question is whether they are willing to let the separation of powers and the rule of law operate in such a way that it's easy to throw them out of office again. And that has not always been the case. Where the phrase of authoritarian populism is useful to me, nevertheless, is that it describes a set of political actors, which include both Donald Trump and people like Jair Bolsonaro and people like Recep Erdogan, who derive from their claim that they alone represent the people a disdain for the rule of law and for checks and balances.
Alejandro?
You know, there's a way in which populism and authoritarianism get conflated as one-to-one, but in fact, what has been historically true in Latin America is that the nature of the previously existing regime also not only constrains, but also enables other forms of politics to rise. And so in the 20th century, for instance, it has been at the hand of what we would call populists, where the greatest expansion of social and economic rights have come. And that's because historically institutions, the kinds of things that we valorize and hold aloft in places like, you know, Western Europe or the United States, have been the bulwarks of entrenched elites. And that grants these populist leaders some degree of legitimacy. In the case of somebody like Donald Trump, certainly you see the concentration of executive power, the requirement of loyalty. But to some extent, of course, this ignores the fact that these are not historically new in the history of the United States. Even the idea of how, you know, we elect our presidents in the United States is highly contestable, right? And so to some extent, what Trump has done is highlighted some of these deeper deficiencies in the institutional apparatus in the United States rather than started them anew. And so I would also caution against seeing what Trump is doing as somehow new or different, and to some extent to understand it as part and parcel of longer histories of political marginalization in the United States.
Just briefly, I mean, I wanted to say that I think another issue is that in the United States, we seem to be consistently looking at Trump and comparing him to Orban or Duterte or whoever else, when in reality there was for a long time in the United States, a system in the South that was essentially very similar to what we're talking about, you know, a democratic facade, which it was essentially an authoritarian system in which a variety of different populists ruled state and local elections, completely disenfranchised voters saw themselves as the epitome of the popular will, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think actually one of the mistakes the last few years is to constantly look to, although there are similarities, so to constantly think that this is something new that has happened in the United States and shocking, whereas to recognize that in actuality in the United States, we had long, long periods of this in large swaths of the country, in most of the old Confederacy, in which many or all of the characteristics that we're describing here were actually in place.
Right now we see that the president is finishing up a trip in India, is buddy-buddy with Narendra Modi, another person who invokes this term of authoritarianism. Do leaders who ascribe to these kinds of principles, do they tend to learn from each other's playbook?
Yeah, I think this is one of the obvious ways in which we're protesting a little bit too much in this conversation, saying, oh my God, I mean, you know, really to try and compare Donald Trump to somebody like Jair Bolsonaro or somebody like Narendra Modi is completely wrong. But what's striking is the extent to which Donald Trump sees himself as the natural ally of all of the different people who we've mentioned in this conversation, with the exception of some of the left-wing populists like Hugo Chavez. He sees himself as ideologically aligned to Viktor Orban. He sees himself as ideologically aligned to Jair Bolsonaro and now Narendra Modi in India. And I think that he's onto something there.
I just want to thank and congratulate, though, President Erdogan. He's a friend of mine, and I'm glad we didn't have a problem because, frankly, he's a hell of a leader, and he's a tough man. He's a strong man.
Brazil's relationship with the United States because of our friendship is probably better than it's ever been by far.
Viktor Orban has done a tremendous job in so many different ways. Highly respected, respected all over Europe. Probably like me, a little bit controversial, but that's okay.
They share a vision of politics. They share an impatience, a disrespect for the idea that there might be true political pluralism, that decent people can come to different conclusions about what we should do in our countries or who our leader should be. I still believe that that is the best framework for understanding this political moment in the United States and in India and in Brazil and in large parts of Europe. The fact that Donald Trump's attorney general has asked prosecutors to reduce their suggestions for what kind of prison term Roger Stone should have. This is an explicit way in which the president and his allies are trying to influence how justice is done in a criminal trial.
The forewoman of the jury, the woman who was in charge of the jury, is totally tainted. When you take a look, how can you have a person like this? She was a anti-Trump activist. Can you imagine this?
So I think this concept of authoritarian populism certainly helps us to understand what's going on here. And a lot of these kinds of news stories, if you changed a few names and changed a few geographical locations, look eerily like what you might have read about Turkey, about some of those other countries like Hungary, 5 or 10 years ago.
Alejandro, I saw you kind of grimacing a minute ago. What was that all about?
Yeah. No, I guess just listening to Yasha, there's much of what he says that I agree with. But the fact is that the institutions of the state that we used to, you know, hold up as the reasons why the United States, U.S. democracy was more expansive and more representative are, in fact, working. And they're just working on behalf of their particular interests, which is to stay in power. The impeachment trial, right, you could say many things about it, but in the end, institutionally, procedurally, it actually functioned as designed. But I also think it is, to some extent, to use Josh's words, naive to imagine that the institutions of the United States are already or had been, you know, somewhat as strong as is being suggested.
Joshua, when we see populist leaders leaving office, what tends to happen?
Well, sometimes they don't leave office willingly, at least in Southeast Asia. And you have a secondary problem in which people who desperately want to get rid of a liberal populist themselves become fixated with a variety of white knight solutions. You also have a problem where a lot of times in the face of these illiberal populists, opposition fractures. Sometimes it fractures even before they come into office, and they spend their time squabbling rather than recognizing the greatest threat. This has certainly happened in the Philippines. It's happened in Thailand. I mean, you could argue it's happened in a lot of places. And the second thing that often happens is once, even if you were able to get that liberal populist out of office, you've often created a situation in which he or she has so degraded institutions and the political discourse that people are distrustful and cynical. And what happens is you wind up with a future, another illiberal populist in office, sometimes even worse. So that's a second problematic scenario that can happen.
Well, I mean, right now we're looking at the Democratic Party, you know, who seems to be panicking over the possibility of Bernie Sanders becoming the nominee. Alejandro, is there anything you want to draw upon from the Latin American context that you think is germane to this conversation?
Yeah, actually, I think what Josh was mentioning before about the opposition tending to splinter as they try to challenge authoritarians is right on. And I completely agree with what you mentioned, that that is to some extent what we're seeing in terms of the Democratic Party splintering and this sort of hyperventilation about Bernie Sanders' potential to challenge Trump. You know, I guess the other thing that I would say in terms of Latin America is that this other example of the white knight is something we've seen recently, right? So in places like Venezuela, you know, Juan Guaido, who emerged last year as a potential alternative to Maduro, you know, came in sort of with the support of the United States and many other Western democracies, but also was doing so, you know, holding up a message that all they needed to do was get the support in order to oust Maduro from power. And that was a fundamental misreading of the dynamics of how deeply entrenched, as Yasha was mentioning, authoritarians, you know, become quite quickly, as in the case of Nicolas Maduro. So yeah, Latin America certainly poses examples, although I would say this and I would insist on the point, I don't actually think that Donald Trump is undermining U.S. institutions. I think what's particular and sui generis and unique about Donald Trump is that he understands keenly how institutions and the institutional design of the United States can be actually deployed to satisfy authoritarian goals.
And so you think he's a one-off and that if he were to be, I guess, succeeded by someone else that the institutions would hold?
No, I feel like the issue is that the institutions are holding him, right? Yeah. So, for instance, I don't think that his electoral strategy is to win the popular vote. I think the electoral strategy is to win the Electoral College. But it is entirely plausible that you might have another, perhaps wider, popular majority margin that, in fact, does not lead to the election of that candidate. And so, you know, would that be considered a failure of institutions? I am again and again surprised by how little talk there is of Electoral College reform in the context of thinking precisely about these questions about the solidity or lack thereof of U.S. institutions. That is the fundamental one. You can have free and fair elections. You can have low barriers to entry. You can have significant amounts of voter turnout. But in the end, it is entirely plausible that the popular majority candidate does not win. And I feel like one more of those elections would prove the point, actually, that it's not the failure of U.S. institutions to harness somebody like Donald Trump, but it is embedded in their original design that allows this to happen.
I've been speaking with Alejandro Velasco, associate professor at NYU, Joshua Kurlancic, senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Yasha Monk, associate professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. All of you, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, I want to take a second here to tell you about a new weekly podcast from The Takeaway. It's called How to Vote in America, and it's hosted by our own Amy Walter. Every week, she'll take one piece of our crazy election process and break it down in 10 minutes or less. First up, what the heck is Super Tuesday, and how did it come to be? Find How to Vote in America today on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. All week, we've been talking about guns and domestic violence on the show. Today, we'll conclude our series by talking about some solutions to the problem of gun violence in intimate partner settings by hearing from two states who are taking particularly aggressive approaches. Texas has had a difficult time combating domestic violence by gun due to the state's lax gun laws. So the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Texas decided to step in and help. Meanwhile, Colorado, like a number of other states, has put a law in place that gives a family member, household member, or law enforcement officer the ability to petition the court to temporarily remove someone's access to firearms if they pose a risk of committing violence. States across the country have high hopes that so-called red flag laws will help reduce gun violence. But in Denver, they're also trying something a little more radical. We spoke with Heidi Mawagde of KERA in Dallas and Lee Patterson of KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. They're both reporting fellows for Guns in America National Reporting Collaborative. I first asked Lee to take us inside the Denver DA's office for a look at their interesting new approach.
Recently, the DA's office did hire someone who they're calling a domestic violence investigator. And so what this individual does is he monitors the cases that come through that office. He is looking for people who have been charged with domestic violence related offenses and who have a restraining order against them and who could possess firearms. So he is on the phone with victims, family members, neighbors, listening to 911 calls, going through social media to see if there is evidence of this individual possessing firearms, which in most cases is not legal. Prosecutors can then use that evidence to go ask a judge for a search warrant to remove the guns, or sometimes the removal is just worked out in the courthouse on the fly by lawyers as a condition of bond release. And, you know, a lot about this position is under wraps. They're not giving out his name, and they're also not making him available for interviews. But so far, this investigator has reviewed over 1,000 cases in his first couple months on the job, and he's helped remove 49 guns from 14 people.
So this is a very specific subset of cases, and yet 1,000 cases, that's a lot.
And even though, as I just said, there is quite a bit about this position that's under wraps, Maggie Conboy, Senior Chief Deputy District Attorney, who oversees the Special Victims Unit, she did describe one scenario to me just to give you an idea of how this all works. So recently, her colleague was in court and he was on the phone with the investigator who was with the victim. And this lawyer is feeding the investigator information about the situation. The investigator is in the house in question with the victim looking for weapons, and he ultimately did find 200 pounds of ammunition in the basement along with the owner's manuals for a couple of weapons.
Heidi, Erin Neely Cox is the U.S. State's Attorney for the Northern District of Texas. She's also taking a new approach. Can you tell me a little about her plan?
Yeah, so Erin Neely Cox came into office in 2017, and when she did, you know, there was a gun violence epidemic, as she phrased it to me, not only in America, but in northern Texas, which is a huge district. I mean, it's the size of some states on the Northeast, and it includes rural communities as well as urban communities. And what she saw was that gun violence was a major factor. And she did sort of a Venn diagram of violence, gun violence, and then in the middle of that Venn diagram was domestic violence abusers, both known and convicted or simply charged. And so she went out to police officers and to district attorneys and to state judges, and she made herself available. She made her office available. She let them know that these people are violating gun laws, you know, state, federal gun laws, and that she can do something about it and that she was willing to do something about it. And her office has started taking up these cases and convicting men of, you know, 30 months in prison, in a federal prison, in which it's a lot harder to get out of than some of the stuff you face when you're going against a state judge or state court. And then she had so much success about it that the Department of Justice actually started a working group of U.S. attorneys across the nation. I think it's about 11 or 12 deep now, and they're sharing these practices in Ohio, in Washington, in Louisiana, in Oklahoma, and U.S. attorneys now across the nation are using this as a tool to decrease overall gun violence.
Both Maggie Conboy in Denver and the U.S. State's Attorney for Northern District in Texas, Erin Neely Cox, both women, do either of them suggest that being women informs their approach to these reforms?
I would tell you Erin Neely Cox was sort of taken aback when I asked her that. I said, well, you know, you're a woman. I imagine that on Twitter, a lot of men who are pro-gun and don't want you to take this away are upset at you, specifically for being a woman taking guns away from abusers. And she laughed. She laughed at my face. She goes, this is about making people safer. And people who own guns want safer worlds. And they want laws to be upheld and to be taken care of. She goes, this is not about me being a woman. Because if you look at the other U.S. attorneys who are working on this, they're not women. And they are taking this just as seriously.
Do you see these models in Colorado and Texas being emulated in other parts of the country?
The DA's office here in Denver says that their domestic violence investigator is the only person in that particular role in the state of Colorado. My understanding is that this kind of thing is happening here and there locally in other parts of the country. For example, in Kings County, which is in Washington State, so the Seattle area, a couple of years ago, they formed a task force made up of, you know, police, district attorney, to tackle the problem of domestic violence. They're trying to get guns out of the hands of domestic violence suspects. So that's kind of similar to what the domestic violence investigator here in Denver is doing. A program in place in California goes much, much further. It's called APPS, which stands for the Armed and Prohibited Person System. It's been in place for years, and it basically allows law enforcement to cross-reference the state's firearms registry with the names of individuals who have become prohibited from firearms ownership. So if you're a police officer, you can enter a person's name to find out if they are both armed and prohibited.
And I can tell you what Erin Neely Cox is doing at the federal level, it is being replicated throughout the United States. And district attorneys are working with U.S. attorneys and police officers as well. I think people are excited about the fact that they could harness the power of federal gun laws to help keep people safe. So, yes.
Heidi Mwagdi of KERA in Dallas is a reporting fellow for Guns in America, as is Lee Patterson of KUNC in Northern Colorado. Thank you so much for both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know is affected by intimate partner violence and needs help, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE for support in either English or Spanish. That's 1-800-799-7233. You can find all our pieces from this week at thetakeaway.org/guns, where you'll also find our series on guns and suicide from earlier this year. I'm Arun Venugopal, and you're back with The Takeaway. And now, a discussion on wrongful convictions.
I was scared, terrified, because I'd never been in trouble with law before.
When Robert Davis was just 18, he says he was coerced into confessing to two murders he did not commit, and he ended up spending 13 years in prison.
So I was complying and doing what I was supposed to do and what I was told to do, and basically I was told I was being arrested for murder.
He was exonerated in 2016. Now Davis, along with one of his lawyers, Laura Nyreiter, is trying to change the country's understanding of wrongful convictions, in part through a new podcast on this issue.
Because there's a lot of innocent people that are in prison and everything. It's just, it's crazy. And there needs to be change in that.
I asked Laura, who's an attorney from Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions, to describe Davis's case.
Just outside Charlottesville, Virginia, he's picked up in the middle of the night by police officers and hauled into the police station and accused of a double murder of a neighbor that lived down the street. And here's Robert. He's 18 years old, a high school senior. The whole overnight interrogation is caught on video. And what the video shows is absolutely shocking, right? You've got Robert not knowing what's going on. This is all out of the blue for him. And the officers bring him in. They accuse him of this double murder. And they begin lying to him about the evidence against him. They tell him that his DNA was found at the crime scene, even though it wasn't. And then they tell him that he's facing the death penalty unless he confesses. And this goes on and on and on overnight. Robert's asking for his mom. He gets a no. He asks to take a polygraph to prove his innocence. They tell him no. And finally, he breaks and he says, "What can I say I did to get me out of this?" One of the clearest moments of the sort of psychological breaking point of interrogation that I've ever heard. And then they feed him information about the crime. He adopts it. He repeats it back. He weaves it all together into a confession. And then at the end of the tape, by about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, he looks up at them and says, "Do you think by me telling you all this that I'm going to get to go home?" And they look at him and they say, "What are you talking about? You just confessed to double murder. You're going to jail." And he says, "Why am I lying to you about all this just so I can go home? Because I am lying to you." One of the clearest, most immediate recantations I've ever seen. And based on that confession and nothing else, Robert Davis was sentenced to 23 years in prison as an 18-year-old. He served 13 and a half years before being exonerated.
This is, I guess, the nightmare that we all associate with some sort of dystopian sort of reality, but obviously happens all across America. Why was none of this evidence, why did it not come to light at the time?
Well, you're right. I mean, these are stories that are being told right now, right? We had the story of my client, Brendan Dassey, and making a murderer. Then, of course, Ava's retelling of the Central Park Five, the Exonerated Five's story in When They See Us. These stories are coming out and grabbing the popular consciousness in an incredible way because of the injustice of these of what's happening to these innocent, you know, teenagers. And what's fascinating to me, you know, Robert Davis had one of the best lawyers in the state of Virginia. He fought his case. He fought his confession. But what's interesting is that nothing that happened in that interrogation room, as shocking as it is to all of us, nothing that happened in the Central Park Five's interrogations, for that matter, or we're told by the courts, even in Brendan Dassey's interrogation, none of it is illegal. We may find it immoral. We may find it appalling. But none of it is illegal. It's all permitted tactics. So that's a big part of what we're trying to do by telling these stories in our podcast, is show folks, you know, it's not just a New York City thing. It's not just a Manitowoc, Wisconsin thing. This happens, like you say, all over America. And by telling these stories again and again, we can start identifying ways to solve the problem of false confessions.
So let's get to the solutions. I mean, on the Wrongful Conviction podcast, you say there should be checks and balances for this, meaning other police officers reviewing tapes as well as prosecutors and judges. But in reality, how does this play out?
Well, in reality, only 26 states require interrogations to be recorded at all. And that's a phenomenon that really came about only in the last 10 or 15 years or so. So all of this audio that we have, all of this video that we have from inside the interrogation room is brand new. All this glimpse that we're suddenly being allowed, you know, inside this hitherto secret space. It's all brand new stuff. So one of the most important reforms is getting those other 24 states simply to adopt rules requiring electronic recording of interrogations. But that's only the first step. That's only the step of developing the record of what happens in the room. Then you got to look at the record. You got to look at it with objective eyes, and you've got to have a legal framework in place that recognizes what every layperson sees when you hear these stories, which is, this is wrong. It shouldn't happen this way. It doesn't lead to voluntary confessions. It doesn't lead to reliable confessions.
In one part of the episode, you mentioned that law enforcement officials are allowed to lie during interrogations. Do many people in the public know that this is allowed?
I didn't know until I went to law school. No, I don't think many people know at all that police in the United States are allowed to lie about the evidence during interrogations. So when you listen to Robert Davis's episode, you'll hear the police telling him that they found his DNA at the crime scene, and that because they have his DNA, there's no way he's going to be able to convince anyone that he's innocent. But of course, that's a lie. There was no DNA whatsoever. And then they go a step further because they tell Robert, this 18-year-old kid, no criminal history, no experience with police, they tell him, you know what, Robert, we can't lie to you about the evidence. They're lying about lying. It's incredibly manipulative, incredibly deceptive. And that's one of the first reforms that needs to happen. There's actually a bill that was introduced recently in New York, one of the first bills of its kind in the United States, proposing that this kind of deception be outlawed during interrogations, precisely because it is such a known risk factor for false confessions.
Tell us about Robert. What's his life like now?
You know, Robert's a great guy. He is an absolute survivor. I'm proud to know him, and I'm proud to have been part of the team that fought for him. Robert got out in 2015. He was formally exonerated in 2016, and he is living a rich life. He's back in the Charlottesville area where he grew up. He's working at an electrical union, working 5 days a week, full-time job. And he just got engaged a few months ago, which is a wonderful thing. So he's moving on with his life. He's rebuilding it as best he can. You know, there's real trauma that comes from enduring, you know, incarceration of any kind. But of course, particularly wrongful convictions of innocent folks. Robert's been through the ringer, and I'm so proud of what he's been able to do with his life.
So how can a court or a state make amends for holding an innocent person like Robert behind bars for so long?
You know, 33 states have adopted statutes that permit compensation of some kind to people who have been wrongly convicted and wrongly incarcerated. That means, of course, that there are 17 states that don't offer any compensation whatsoever. But even in the 33 states that do, the amount of compensation that we're talking about can be just appallingly low, you know, $10,000 a year. Something like that. So for folks who lose 30 years of their life to wrongful incarceration, innocent folks, the amount of compensation that they're getting through these statutory schemes is just not adequate at all. It's not adequate to reflect what they've endured and what they've lost. So we're still making strides, frankly, on making amends to the people that have suffered at the hands of these egregious errors.
Laura Nyreiter, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, everyone. Thank you so much.
Take care. Robert Davis's story and many others can be heard in the new podcast, Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions. And that's all for us this week, except for a quick shout out to the team here, our producer squad. Ethan Opperman, Jackie Martin, Jose Olivares, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, and Jason Tureski. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer, Vince Fairchild is our technical engineer, and Jay Cowett, our director. Both of those cats handle our wicked sound design as well. Our digital editor is Polly Irungu. Katrina Barton is our intern. David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill, our executive producer. Today is my last day filling in for Tanzina Vega, and it has truly been a privilege. These are messy times, but I'm grateful to have had the chance trying to make sense of them with you, and to have been able to work these early morning hours with the team that puts The Takeaway together every single day. They are brilliant at what they do, and they actually care. So while Tanzina continues her maternity leave through the next few months, there's a great lineup of guest hosts following my lead. Next up is Duarte Geraldino, who you've heard before on this show. He's taking you through March on Mondays through Thursdays, and of course, Amy Walter continues each and every Friday. It's been great being with you. This is The Takeaway. See you next time.